think we should start. I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome everyone to this unique event, a brainstorming session.
Well, I don't want to say welcome to the real world. That's not the real world. You must dream until you die. With that, I think the agenda is self-explanatory. I think I should hand over to Mr. Sokutu to take us through.
Thank you very much, Chair. It is indeed very good to be here. It does remind me of my former life, which seems to be long, long time ago now. But it's good to be back and engaging with legislators on these important matters that are facing our country. Chair and honourable members, you will recall that at the last formal interaction that we had, when we made a presentation on the state of transformation of the industry, there was a request by yourselves to engage with us in a form of a brainstorming session to try and kick around some ideas about what could be done and try to understand better what are the drivers of lack of progress as we would have liked to date. We understand this not to be a decision-making session. We understand it to be truly a brainstorming session to exchange ideas among each other. And perhaps out of that, we might be able to take some recommendations, things either we go and implement as a taxa or things that we might want to recommend to the department and to the minister. Chair, as a starting point, perhaps I should introduce, I don't know if all the members of council are known to the portfolio members. I think maybe it's useful to ask themselves to just say who they are, not elaborate in terms of why they're no longer wearing red socks, but just say who they are and where they come from. Thank you. Starting right at the end, please. Council members.
My name is A.D. Corsa. I'm the council member.
I'm Jeffrey Ndumo. I'm the member of the Tourism Empowerment Council, South Africa. I'm wearing blue socks now.
Good morning. My name is Dennis George. I'm the General Secretary of FEDUSA and I'm representing organized labor on the council. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Julian McMahon. I'm also a council member of TEXA.
My name is Cindy Santumayo. I'm a council member. I'm also from DIT. Thank you.
My name is Anita Sony. I'm Deputy Chair of TEXA.
My name is Bula Musupia, Acting CEO of the Tourism Empowerment Council.
Thank you very much. Chair, we reported last time when we engaged with you, we made a presentation which, in a nutshell, highlighted certain areas of progress and certain areas where there was not adequate progress. We also made reference to a study that was made and presented to the president by the big business working group, which also basically mirrored a similar study, which in a nutshell showed that overall there was inadequate progress in terms of transformation in the country in general, but we also said specifically in the tourism sector is the same thing. Now, the other thing that you presented to yourselves was that the tourism industry is characterized by a pyramid kind of structure in terms of numbers of companies and how they contribute to the bottom line that contributes to the GDP, which basically stated that overall we have relatively few companies. When I say relatively few, I'm probably talking about between 20 and 30. that contribute between 70% and 80% of the revenue within tourism, and therefore the contribution to the national GDP. Now, this is within the background of an industry that has got more than 1,000 SMMEs in the sector that are playing in the tourism sector. And therefore, one of the important issues is the role that is played by these few companies in opening up opportunities for the small industries, for the small entrepreneurs who are trying to make it in the tourism industry. But the other issue is that, which I want to just refer to very quickly, some of you may have listened to a debate on SAFM yesterday morning. It's kind of thing that keeps me company when I'm in the Joburg traffic every morning. I listen to those debates. This was on BEE in South Africa. They quoted a recent survey that was done by KPMG that also showed, according to the survey, that generally speaking, there is inadequate progress, and in fact, there's regression in certain areas of transformation in general under BEE in South Africa. Now, this is a debate that has happened only yesterday, so it's not a long time ago. So the question, therefore, that we grapple with as the council is, and has been and continues to be, what are the things that can be done by the council in the first instance to assist industry to move faster on the transformation agenda? But the second thing is, why is the industry within the tourism sector finding it difficult to progress in certain areas of the scorecard? I mean, we heard yesterday in that debate that in areas such as ownership, there has been, in fact, in general, a regression. Now, I'm not sure how it holds today in terms of ownership in the tourism sector, but when we reported last time, ownership was one of those areas where there was a fair amount of progress in the various subcategories of the tourism industry. The area of strategic representation, which is about senior management, board representation, etc., was an area that was also highlighted in the debate yesterday. What came through out of that debate was that in those areas there's been some regression. And one of the things that was discussed was that perhaps the reason why after 14 years there's still a problem with representation of black people in senior structures of corporations is because there isn't adequate pools. There aren't adequate pools from which companies should draw from that they have created themselves through intervention in terms of training and development. That was one of the areas that that came through. The other was that perhaps there is a narrow-minded approach to what is a qualified person, because the point that was raised was that there are a number of people who are actually graduates, who may not necessarily be graduates in hospitality industry-related discipline, for example, but who obviously, because they are graduates, they can be retrained and reskilled fairly quickly. When I say fairly quickly, I'm not trying to undermine the importance and perhaps whatever difficult there is there, but to say that it's better than somebody who does not have a degree or someone who's not educated. The other area was specifically the area of women, which I think is highlighted in another slide here. It doesn't show, but was the area of women representation, which was an area of challenge as well within the tourism sector. But I think more challenging will be interventions that are designed, given the structure of the tourism industry, interventions that will be designed to absorb as many of the smaller players as possible, or to provide them opportunities for them to provide services to the bigger players or alongside the bigger players. I have seen some studies in places, for example, like the U.S., where there is a structured intervention which looks at the life cycle requirements of small entrepreneurs, starting from pre-screening of small entrepreneurs to screening all the way to the time when they then develop their companies, they grow, and then they become big companies. But all the time, there's a hand-holding process right through until they become big companies. But that is a dedicated, structured, deliberate intervention that is meant to move the SME sector. So my view, honorable members, is that apart from the work that big corporations should do within themselves in order to embrace transformation in practice in the areas of employment equity, which we see that there's still a big struggle in the areas of, and I'm referring specifically in the senior positions, where you find sometimes in companies that they've got one or two very senior people, and then they don't have others in the senior positions and as well as middle management. Now, again, I'm not undermining the difficulties and challenges there, but I'm just saying that that's what pertains even today in our country. Then the second thing is on this issue of interpretation of the various technicalities within the terminology. For example, the issue of ownership. How do you score in ownership is dependent not just on the fact that we've done a 10% deal, for example, but it's dependent on having done the deal, having people influencing the company, and having economic see-through in terms of benefits. And you may score in one of those sub-areas, but don't score in others. In fact, if you don't score in the influence, it might actually take your points down from an ownership point of view. So that's another area of technical difficulty which we have to look at and try and clarify. In my view, even from the side of the BEE codes or now sector codes, where there are sector codes, there are still things that need to be clarified and perhaps even made simpler to be understood and to be implemented. The other thing I'd like to put on the table for discussion, which has been around for a while, which also read its head yesterday in the debate, was the whole issue of BEE code of good practice versus the sector codes. Because this debate has been around, I have been in meetings again at presidential level where this question was put to the meeting as to why do we need sector codes and why do we need BEE codes. And some people have the view that the BEE codes of good practice are adequate to actually, and they are robust enough, and those are the words that I used yesterday, robust enough and flexible enough to accommodate all the various sectors. So the question is, why have them? In other words, why are we here representing a charter, a sector charter, which is the tourism one? And this also applies to the finance charter and to the others as well. So I think I'd like to put this on the table without any predetermined view, but also seeing that it does inform progress or lack thereof, and there are people who've got views about whether we should go one way or the other. It'll be useful to put on the table. Chair, those are a way of opening remarks. The one last thing perhaps that I should mention before I give any other member of the council that to make an input is the issue that is related to the issue of small entrepreneurs, which I raised earlier, which is the question of access to finance. But I think that when you address the issue of access to finance, we need to be a lot more sophisticated and complex about it, not to be simply not to simplify it and not approach it from a simplicity point of view. In my experience, on one end, you do have a problem of lack of people who have experience, who've got companies, etc., who, because of the risk-averse kind of predisposition of funding institutions in South Africa, do not get access to funding. But on the other hand, in my view, there is a whole lot of people who are actually not ready to accept finance because they won't know what to do with it once they've got it. And I think sometimes we brush this over, and reality is there are people who have had access to finance who have failed because that's not the panacea to our problems in terms of small entrepreneurs, not only the tourism sector, but across the board. And then the third issue related to that is all the hurdles that small entrepreneurs have to go through
was a study that showed that South Africa is one of the most difficult places for a small business to function from the point of view of regulations that are there, that are hampering the formalities that are required, et cetera, et cetera. And that particular study was pointing out to the fact that in a country where you have so many of these in rural areas, have no access to all of this stuff, it should be made easier rather than more difficult in terms of formalities that are required from a regulation point of view, filling on different forms, all that kind of stuff. Again, I'm not saying that these things should not be done. I'm saying it's the extent to which we put them and then they become hurdles for progress going forward. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sokoto. Over to you.
Would any member of the council want to make an input?
Good morning, colleagues. I just want to speak on the issue of funding for small businesses in particular. Now, this industry is a very difficult industry to from a labor point of view to organize, you know, because of the smallness and all these kinds of challenges. But what we have heard from entrepreneurs in the sector is that they are entirely on their own when it comes to funding and receiving funding from the different state enterprises and also from the commercial banks. And if they are successful to get funding, then the cost of the funding is very high. And then also the transaction cost, because you remember the Competition Commission is currently busy with a study from their own, an investigation into the cost that we are paying as we're sitting around the table as individuals for our doing business with. So the cost is very expensive. And we know for small businesses, this is really, really a challenge. And I think from not just from the council's point of view, but I think from the view of government, there has to be something done to help these entrepreneurs, because otherwise we're not going to transform as quickly as we want to transform, because of number one, the cost of funding, and then when you have the funding, when you want to do the transactions with the commercial banks, their cost is very high. Even the cost that they have to pay to Kula, because Kula for that indemnity are also asking costs. Now, if you look and compare those challenges to a challenge for the larger enterprises or the listed enterprises, they don't have to go to the commercial banks to raise capital to run their businesses. They raise money from the stock exchange. That money comes cheaper. They can negotiate and they can push for very and for better rates when they deal with the commercial banks. Now, there was only one commercial bank that came up with a campaign. Now, I know my chairperson, and I must be very careful now. He is a member from this African bank, you see. This Nedbank, for instance, came with a proposal to say they want to give small businesses that are younger than 2 years old, like a 2-year freezing, you see. So. And then you have to look. So I think maybe from the council side, what we will need to do on this issue is to do a specific study on the issue of the funding, on the cost of the funding, and then secondly, what can be done to address this particular challenges. Then I want to just to point out to the colleagues, this is a study that's been done by the OECD. The Minister of Finance invited them to come here, and they did a study. The OECD is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. South Africa is not a party to this body, but obviously they've done the study for us. It's been released the end of July. It has a session that deals specifically with the BEE challenge and the issues that we want to look at and make some recommendations. It's obviously, you can download it from the website. I think one of the key areas that we will really need to work hard on and to pay our attention to, if that is the one issue on the finance. And then the other issue is, and I know government is busy working on a new document, what is called the Human Resource Development Strategy from 2009 to 2014 going forward. It's probably going to be released in the next month or so. So it deals specifically with the issue of the management side, because Chairperson mentioned this thing, but we are also seeing this thing happening continuously, is the pool of people where we can get people from. So clearly our education system in this country doesn't currently give us enough people. You know, so Professor Hutchinson from Princeton University made this quote, and he said the following words. He said, look, any nation that wants to make progress need to look after the human capital. You see, now I heard many politicians and business people were complaining. The investment that we make through the skilled levies, it's a wasteful investment. I must say to you that is incorrect. That is a good investment. Because once you empower that citizen and you have invested money in him, when he is progressing like some of us, afterwards that citizen comes back and he pays back that investment that we as a state and a civil society made in him many, many, many times over, because he will pay his taxes, you see. So the more we lift up our people with the human resources, when that person becomes an active participant in the economy and he pays his taxes through VAT, pay issue and all these things, that again gives opportunity. So I think the point is that the finance and the HR is very important for us, and that is our commitment, but we obviously have to do much more work on that.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I just want to really join on what the Chairperson of our Tourism Council have raised. The point that I think in dealing with the hurdle rate of small businesses in South Africa in terms of cost, because one of the hurdle rate really to do business in South Africa is the cost of capital, whereby it becomes very expensive to do business in South Africa. What we have done, I think, particularly on the BEE side, is to ensure that we do provide exemptions. And what this particular charter is stipulating very explicitly is that, I think our chairperson pointed out that few companies are the ones that are expected to meet BEE, and those tends to be your large and your medium enterprises, which where 70% of the value of the entire industry is located. And therefore, the other ones, which some of them are SMEs and micros, which are in the number of thousands, we have said that from a threshold of about 5 million, really annual turnover, those will be exempted from doing BEE in this particular sector, which then means that almost really about, in a sense, of those 1,000 SMEs, you might be looking at a scenario whereby 60% of them are not expected in any way to do BEE. So in that particular regard, we need to be very clear that in terms of performance on BEE, a number of businesses, particularly within the sector, where the majority of them are either micro, they are small, are exempted because we put a 5 million a threshold to do BEE. So in that particular aspect, those entities will not be emitting any particular BEE in that regard. So at that point, we need to understand it very clearly, so that when people are saying the industry is not transforming, it is not true, because the bulk of those industries have already, by in terms of our own particular instruments, have been exempted to meet BEE requirements. That's the first point that I just want to very much bring to the attention of the committee. And then also the other issue which I think needs to be articulated very clear is that those entities that are exempted, they enjoy an automatic level 4 recognition in terms of the recognition on BEE performance. So once they are at...
As you use some of the terminology to explain it, don't assume that we are on top of each and everything in tourism.
All right. I think that is, I mean, I don't know which one which is not interesting. Oh, yes, there are levels of performance which are articulated in the Code of Good Practice. It's from level 1 right up to level 8. So a company that is doing better would be the one that is at level 1. The one that is doing extremely good, it would be level 1.
And then, of course, lesser than that one, level 2, level 3, and level 4. So right up to level 8. So what it means is that when a company is at level 4, it means, therefore, it is really performing, it enjoys a 60% benefit on the scorecard in terms of its particular performance. So that's what we mean by that particular level. So in a sense, then, in this particular factor, we need to appreciate that the bulk of these SMMEs are not going to do PE. So if you're going to talk about transformation, you need to know that they are outside that particular requirement. That's the first point. And then the second point that I think I need to mention very clearly is around, there is still a challenge, particularly which is impacting on transformation in South Africa, which is something that we need to deal with. It's around the relationship between the codes of good practice, as well as the Preferential Procurement Act in South Africa. We are currently, because most of these entities, particularly the ones that need to transform, you find that they've realized that at the moment the Preferential Procurement Act doesn't require broad-based ownership, broad-based PE or empowerment to be implemented. It only specified what you call narrow-based, which it says it looks at only ownership and management as a requirement to meet BEE. And therefore, it then means practically that, by and large, most companies, that instrument and that lever is a pressure lever to bring about transformation, is not playing its particular role. And therefore, it's something that currently we are busy with National Treasury to try to sort out is the Department of Trade and Industry, so that that particular lever can begin to play its particular role. But it's something that is long overdue, and it needs to be put very fast. And I think we have made our submission as the Department of Trade and Industry to National Treasury. They have to, therefore, at any particular time, announce that particular amendment of the PPFA Act, so that it begins to play that particular pressure, because most of the entities that are doing business with government find that they tend to escape to meet the broad-based empowerment requirement as specified by the codes of good practice. And particularly within this industry will be the case, because most of them are within the tourism, and then we use them when we fly around, and then all of these particular entities. So it will be to the benefit of transforming this industry if that particular matter is dealt with expeditiously as possible. So in that regard, I think we would say that I think from a national point, a national treasury, the minister will have to announce that so that we can see some benefits in that particular regard. In terms of the codes vis-a-vis, the sector codes vis-a-vis the generic codes in that debate, I would say that really what has tended to be the view was that the generic code always supersedes the charters when they are gazetted in terms of Section 12. But as soon as these charters get gazetted under Section 9 of the BEE Act, they then enjoy the legal status equivalent to the generic code. And then in that regard, they then are able to supersede the code of good practice. But until such time that they enjoy that Section 9, they still can be ignored by organs of state when those organs of state are doing business with entities belonging to that particular sector. So in that regard, really, I think the debate around the relationship between sector codes and the generic codes of good practice is something that has long been resolved, really. It's just that what it means that all the sectors now are moving towards speedily getting gazetted under Section 9, so that they can then be in a position to supersede the generic code. Mm-hmm. Because if they are at that level, then it means all entities belonging to that sector code will only be measured in terms of that sector code, not using the generic code. But where they are not, it means the generic code will apply in that particular regard when organs of state are doing business with those. So I thought that particular debate is a debate that is already really closed. What it means then is only that we need to move speedily as sectors to get gazetted under Section 9 of the BEE Act. Those are the contributions I just want to make, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Is there another contributor? I'll see yourself and then.
Chair, thank you very much. You know, we've been, as the council in Azteca, grappling since the days when we brought together all the stakeholders to negotiate the first scorecard on tourism. And one of the things that's abundantly clear is that if in our country, and particularly in the tourism sector, we see transformation as a nice-to-do thing rather than an imperative, it's constantly going to be put into a little bag and kept on the side. And when it's necessary for you to get brownie points and to look good, then somebody pulls it out and does something about it. And one of the things that has happened in tourism, which we're pleased about, that guides our work as TEXA, is the fact that we've adopted a tourism growth strategy. And in most cases, when one looks at growth, you always think about how we're going to grow our share of the cake of the market, as it were. But what we were cognizant of doing, and we did quite effectively, was said, yes, it's great that we can grow the number of people that visit our country, the amount of money they spend in our country, where they visit, in terms of distributing tourism to the various provinces and municipalities. But more importantly, that we were doing all this in our country so that we could transform this industry. And as a result of that, all the work that's done by the various entities, whether they're public entities or private sector, is to an extent driven by that. But the failing would come where TEXA, for example, would be seen as the only institution within the tourism sector that drives transformation. It's got to become the business of everybody in tourism. Whether you are the marketing entities, such as in the case of South African Tourism and the provincial tourism authorities, whether you are TITA, which is our CETA for the tourism sector, how is their work and their business plan being informed by the imperatives of transformation? Are we all singing to the same hymn sheet, as it were? Are we all at one? Our work program talking to our transformation objectives. And to a very large extent, one really talks about also other state-owned enterprises, such as the SA National Parks, with some very good examples of what they've done. But herein lies assets that belong to the people of the country. And are we sufficiently using that to drive the transformation agenda? Or are we looking at everybody doing, through the goodness of the heart, what they would want to do, and we know that doesn't work? So how does one put a program of action into place that speaks to the objectives that TEXA needs to, in the main, monitor and report on? Because that's the role of TEXA, is to watch how transformation is taking place, drive it to an extent that it can by influencing it, but more importantly, monitoring and reporting on it. But the action has got to come from all that's involved in tourism so that we don't put this into a little jar and say it's TEXA's role to drive transformation, because then it won't happen, and it won't happen effectively. So from that point of view, I really want to just conclude by also saying that the one thing we are very aware of, and particularly with all the hype around 2010, is that transformation would only work in the sector if we support sustainable and demand-driven businesses. So we encourage businesses, and like the chair spoke to earlier on, the point around the US model of where we create businesses where somebody wants to buy what they have to sell. And that really is where sustainable development comes from. And to an extent, we plead to people like yourselves, where messages that go out to communities about what the 2010s of the world offer also has the reality of there is life beyond 2010. Okay, thank you.
Introduce yourself so that people can be familiar. We'll also do make that undertaking from the side of the members.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Cindy Sontrumayo. I'm from the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism. I'm partially covered by what Anita said. I was going to focus on what she already said, that in this debate, we need to think about why we need transformation in South Africa as a starting point. And then based on that, zoom in terms of what is happening in the sector. And when we look at the sector, I know that we have seen figures in terms of how tourism has grown, but in really being effective in this debate, we need to interrogate those figures, because the reality of the matter, as much as we talk about the growth of tourism, when you look deeper in terms of the figures, we're still getting the same tourists that we used to get in the past. People who are not interested in the new products that are being brought about, people coming into the economy. So we shouldn't be looking about transformation only from what the BEE Charter Council can do, but we should be looking in an integrated manner. Are we marketing our country in a way that will ensure that we bring the types of tourists who will be interested in the type of products that are going to be offered by the diverse South African experience? When we position ourselves globally, are we positioning ourselves as an African country that is going to offer what we want? So that when we move forward, the solution to this is not going to only come from the BEE Charter Council, because the mandate of the council is to monitor how the sector is progressing. But at the end of the day, for transformation to happen, it's going to be different players playing their role. How we market, how we invest in the skills, how we promote enterprise development. And I feel that I want to quote what I've just heard. I heard something that was said by the brother to the president when he talked about BEE, the reason why BEE is not working. He said the reason why BEE is not working is because BEE is just about moving what exists. What we need in South Africa is to grow our economy. Once we have grown our economy, then it will be easier for us to share. So for me, I think that moving forward, talking as Cindy, so we should be focusing, how are we going to grow this economy so that more people can share from it? And also, how are we going to invest in growing enterprises that are going to take advantage of the growing economy so that we can begin to share? You can have a council being here up to 2014, but if you don't have strategies in place to intensify enterprise development, then we will end up in a situation whereby it's just shifting from the few people who exist, and we're not going to really end up in a situation whereby we brought more people in the mainstream of the economy. So I would like us to think broader than just the council, but also to say what is this out of the box that we can think of that can really fast track transformation in the sector and in South Africa.
Do we have someone else on the other side of the benches who would like to make a contribution? If not, I would then like to take the opportunity and at least put something on the table. I'm a public representative. I represent people who have a different view when it comes to transformation. What it literally means to them is that for a long time, we've never had an opportunity to be able to utilize our own initiatives to make sure that at least we are able to put bread on the table. Now, we are talking about a lot of tourists coming into South Africa. I come from Soweto. That's a tourist destination. But what happens when the tourists go to our townships? They just merely go through the township, take pictures, and they leave. And that's not what we want. What we want is that when tourists come to Soweto, they must spend the night in Soweto, spend their money in Soweto, because clearly there is something that is fascinating. That is why they are coming to Soweto. They won't leave Manhattan and go to Sandton. They've got their own Sandton. That's Manhattan. Similarly, when I visit America, I don't want to go to Manhattan. I've got Sentinel right here. It's the same concrete jungle. But I want to go to Harlem, where the people are. But what the people of Harlem are yearning for is that when I go there, I must spend the night there. I must spend my money there. My money must move around 4 or 5 times over before it can leave that economy. Okay? So my question is this. What are we doing about making sure that when the tourists come to that disadvantaged community, we have prepared that market for those people to appreciate that place, stay there, spend their money there, buy whatever they can buy from that community, and go back to their communities? To me, that would be transformation in the true sense of the word. So that's what I'm putting on the table. What are we doing in order to make sure that we prepare those people? We are talking about 2010 coming. But are those disadvantaged communities going to benefit out of the activities of 2010? And if not, who is responsible to make sure that those people are prepared to make sure that they take fair advantages of the activities around 2010. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Jones, but as I point out, member to speak, can you also make contributions? This is supposed to be a brainstorming session. Okay, so I'm hoping that the members will also be adding to the board. Mr. Jones?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, you know what worries me here is with this BEE. Now, we say there's a difficulty in getting finance and all this. But the couple that do succeed in getting finance, the success rate in that field is inadequate. That is what bothers me. You know, we've been in PE the other day. Now, if we move out of Toronto, then we were speaking about black economic empowerment. We were just 17 quota holders, and only 3 of them were successful. But then what worries me more, Chair, is that there is still white people in this country that must use their money and their powers. Because why, if we sit still, we will see. Here's a BEE company. At the end of the day, Mr. Bayer's not there controls that company. They're not the rightful owners. And we as a government, and the other, before I come there, before I get to that point, the point is, Chair, that we as government, we must, I think we must take them, the black economic empowerment companies, and we must, and private sector too, and we must lead them until they are powerful, until they understand we come from a disadvantaged community. And we can say what we want to. You can't compete with the Ruperts and the point is, Jay, we have to interfere as government to say when you are successful as a BEE member, let us take your hand and lead you through until you can stand on your own 2 feet. Then, never mind how few we take to a success rate, as long as you take some of them up the ladder, the economic ladder, and let them stay up there. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Morgan.
Thanks, Chair. Thank you for those comments, all of them very, very useful. And thank you particularly to the last two speakers who couched some of this argument of transformation in the tourism sector in amongst overall tourism growth. I think it's very, very important. It's complex enough to change the tourism sector. It's arguably easier in a tourism sector that is consistently growing. We're in Tourism Month, And if I'm not mistaken, tourism contributes about 8.4% to our GDP. It's referred to as the new gold, one of the biggest contributors to our economy, and has tremendous potential for growth. Certainly, we should be over 12% quite soon. I have a couple of issues, one creating drivers and the other one creating supply. And I think both of them need to go together in any discussion we have, and I accept, Chair, that this is very much brainstorming. Firstly, I mean, I realize this is an industry which is very, very decentralized, strongly driven by all sorts of forces, but I agree that I think many of the products that are offered are offered. Not that they're wrong, it's just that they're too similar. And I guess this is somewhat similar to Mr. Malalecki's point. We often think of tourism as international tourism. It's not. It's, of course, also domestic tourism. So I say this comment pertaining to both. The products that are advertised regularly, both internationally and domestically, tend to be very, very similar. Package deals, a predominance by certain destinations, perhaps some of the Mpumalanga, Limpopo game reserves, Cape Town, disproportionately. And so there needs to be a lot more work, I would think, that goes into driving tourists, both domestic and internationally, in different areas. Now, I accept you can't... South Africa has a particular image, and everyone knows about Cape Town, everyone knows about the Kruger Park, so I guess you... a lot of people want to go to those places anyway. But I'm sure that more could be done, and more could be done to obviously drive tourists in the direction of those people who are particularly enterprises which are black-owned or majority black-owned. Secondly, and this committee knows my views on this, with regard to the Tourism Grading Council. I ran my own project this year where I questioned every single minister on his or her department's use of graded establishments in South Africa. I haven't got every single reply, but I've got the vast majority, and I can tell you that the replies are astonishing. Government itself is not using, to any great extent, graded establishments in South Africa, and of course grading includes issues of transformation as well. Now, I accept that there are, and I've questioned the Trade Grading Council about this, now, there are also issues of flexibility here. You can't get every single type of product, you know, conference center or X amount of beds or geography. There are always limitations, but it does seem to me to be lower than it should. Another issue on drivers. One of the things certainly that the state owns, which should be better put to use, are our systems of parks. Only two national parks in South Africa are financially viable, and effectively have to cross-subsidize the operation of every other national park in South Africa. And so basically what we're saying here is that the gate takings at these parks, at these other parks, approximately 15 or so, are poor. They're not sufficient enough to actually sustain those parks without transfers from the central fiscus or cross-subsidization. Now, parks are public assets, and this committee in the last few weeks has very much affirmed that. Certainly everyone in this committee agrees with that. But what hasn't nearly happened enough, and this is controversial, I accept, in some sectors, but that commercialization of products within parks is very, very skewed towards certain parks in South Africa, particularly the Kruger Parks and I'm not even sure which others, but it's not something which has been extensively used. So here we have a public asset with a problem of not high enough gate turnings, and here we can even focus on domestic tourism, but there are unique opportunities in national parks, from commercialization, lodges, concessions to local communities and so on, which don't have to be high-end lodges at all, and can also have other things like adventure activities, all which could be used to create drivers to an asset which I don't believe is being used nearly enough in South Africa. And all our provinces are even in a worse state, because many of our provinces, and it's something that has come to this committee in recent weeks as well, are quite happy to hang on to their parks, but the parks are not well run, and it's not a priority of provincial government. Hence, we've just passed, you know, a law which actually allows Sanparks to take over some of the management of provincial parks. So provincial parks also should be looking at commercial activities, and all of these, I guess I'm suggesting, are new ways to create products, particularly for which haven't been done before, which are unique markets, which we can create unique products with exclusive access to black South Africans. With regards to creating supply, the other issue is that I take very well the point of the cost of capital and the regulations that go around small business. I mean, it's not unique to tourism. All small businesses suffer from a huge amount of red tape and regulation, and it takes far more days to register a business in South Africa than it does in many other countries. And, of course, the cost of capital increases during that time, because you can't start attempting to service debt or pay back the capital if you're waiting for registration. So my idea here, and perhaps it exists in some way, is there an opportunity here for the so-called one-stop shop, which could be syndicated around South Africa? Because one of the comments that has been raised here is that there's a lack of information. My colleague also sort of raised the issue of hand-holding and negotiating your way through the difficulties of banks. So, for instance, if Nedbank has a deal for 2 years of no bank charges or whatever it is, I mean, who can help communicate that to the stakeholder? So the one-stop shop seems like a viable way and a good source of public money, because of the potential to negotiate people's way through the trove of regulations and raising capital. Then the FITA, I mean, it would be interesting to have some comments from you on the FITA. I agree that the skills levy is a very, very important thing. I'm not so sure whether the use of that skills levy in FITAs is as good. So what is your view on FITA and its operations, and how, and whether actually the skills transfer and skills training with FITA supposedly do could not be magnified in some other way with a better use of the skills levy? And my last issue is, I do this partly to put you on the spot, actually, because it's coming to me now, and it's not really my attempt to be controversial in any way. But what about, here we have a body which has a certain mandate, which is a noble mandate, and which I agree is an imperative. There are many competing interests in South Africa, and South Africa, this is the Committee of Environment and Tourism, and we have unique environmental products, which I don't even think we've barely begun to even grow in South Africa. So is there a role, if not from the board itself or from even individual council members, take a more activist stance on certain decisions? And here why I say it might be controversial is I look at the recent decision by the Minister of Minerals and Energy to mine the Wild Coast. Now, it's the considered position of DEET and the Minister of Environmental Affairs that tourism is a sustainable option that would create thousands of jobs. And the Minister of Minerals and Energy, who I accept has different prerogative, has granted a mining license, which will create 250 jobs according to the mining application papers. So what I'm trying to say here, isn't there a role? I mean, I accept that conflicts between government departments is part of government, and it happens, and so on. But isn't there a role for some kind of activism in this regard from council members or the board to say, well, you know, here was a unique tourism product which hasn't been used to any great extent at all. It hasn't reached its potential, and possibly now won't reach its potential. It has a unique opportunity to grow local jobs, a local community in a very, very impoverished area, arguably one of the two or three most poor municipalities in South Africa. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let me make some comments as well. Do you want to say something to Dr. Chalia? Okay, no, let me make some comments. I'll come back. I'll allow you to as well. But I want to add my own views to the discussion. I've got a couple of questions and maybe some comments. There is 60%, Mr. Ndumu, that you mentioned, of players in the tourism industry who are not supposed to be involved in the implementation. I'd like to know what revenues do these people generate? What's the money in the sector? I know they are not the big player, but do we have the number? How much is the revenue of that sector? Now, the other question I'd like to ask as well is, in terms of the drivers of this, I think the 30% that controls, I don't know, is it 5%, but that controls 70% of the industry. What are the drivers of that 70%? Is it domestic tourism? Is it international tourism? Okay. I think that would also be useful. Hand-holding. Why are we not having hand-holding in South Africa? What stops us from that hand-holding model, which I think is an important, the wonderful experiences of hand-holding. For instance, there was conditional hand-holding in East Asia in general. There's another version of hand-holding superbly implemented in northern Italy by a company called Norisma, which really incubates small companies and ensure that they've got targets, help them with research, help them with marketing, help them with everything. All you need to come with is not even collateral. You just have to come with a business plan. Okay? If you've got a business plan, you know, business plan can work, and they're not, when they look at the business, they're not trying to find faults in the business plan. They are trying to enhance the business plan. So I'm saying that's another example of hand-holding, a positive example of hand-holding. That has worked for over 30, 35 years, since the 70s, in Bologna. So why are we not having hand-holding here? For instance, such a hand-holding would look at ensuring that all businesses, your bread and breakfast, your guest houses, etc., that they all have got websites, and the government can take the cost of that, so that anyone who wants to come to South Africa, all enterprises are listed, okay, and not only just listed, they are listed also with the actual owner, okay, so that people can go and even indicate what kind of a person owns it. Is it a black person, or is it another person? Last week, I went to a forum in Port Elizabeth of guest houses, and I attended all the jobs. They meet every month. It was a monthly meeting of all the guest houses in Port Elizabeth. And one of the things that came out in that exercise was that one person was asking me, what does Lala Pants mean? Because he wants to call name his guest house Lala Pants. No. So we tried to explain to him, Lala Pants, it's not clear. I mean, it means someone must sleep on the ground, because that's a literal translation. And the person was asking this was an Afrikaner guy. Okay? Because all the guest houses have got black names, African names. Okay? Because people know that tourists want to visit African establishments, some of them. So you are not going to get that market unless you also got an African name. Now, you know, how do we ensure that people are able to have an informed choice? You want to visit a black establishment, you know before you leave London or New York that this is where I'm going to be. So I'm saying, part of what you could do with a head-holding institution would give, for instance, such kind of assistance.
Now, the last question I want to maybe talk about, maybe second last one, is who visits South Africa? Okay? Do we know, I mean, do we have a sense of, of determining what kind of people come here? Okay? Because if you know what kind of people come to South Africa, you are likely to know what kind of people are likely to go to these growth points that things are talking about. I wouldn't see a right-winger from the United States visiting a township, for instance. But maybe a Democrat, maybe someone who votes Labour in the UK may be interested. But if we had a sense of who visits us, I'm not sure how you can determine that. But you can find a way. You can find a skillful way of eliciting. Maybe people fill a form as they come into the country. Part of the form, you might want to ask them a question that can ensure that you understand what kind of values the person represents, so that you can get a sense of who is visiting us. Because there is a whole transformation taking place in the world. For instance, there's the whole issue of what's called the fair trade. There are many people who are interested in not just doing that, what are called ethical tourists. You know, there's a whole segment of people what's called ethical businesses all over the world. People who don't just want to make money, but want to make money and contribute something to the world. Now, how do we attract those people? For instance, is it not better? I mean, again, if we talk about this growth strategy, would it not be useful for tourism South Africa to specifically focus, for instance, let's say in Scandinavia, on trade unions? Okay? In Scandinavia, there's almost 80% unionism in most of the countries. You ensure that every shop steward, every worker in Scandinavia knows the black establishments in South Africa, okay? And is mobilized to visit them. Okay? The same, and you can do it. And you can look at, there are states in America that historically vote progressively. You know, why don't you go there? Because such people are already, disposed to particular markets, to particular values. So I'm saying, maybe we need to bring those dimensions also to into the equation. I'll take the two last hands, and then maybe we can have another. Maybe you can comment on the questions that have come through. Dr. Katalia and Mark Kalan.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Thank you to the presenters for their submissions. I think the obstacles facing transformation have been identified as lack of finance and lack of education. I'd like you to elaborate just a little more on the obstacles. Further obstacles that have been identified, amongst them lack of foreign languages, lack of tourism infrastructure, and lack of community awareness. Thank you very much.
Mark Kalan.
Chairperson, first of all, I would like to know how is TAXA formed? Because, you know, I'm used to us sitting with the team from the government, led by the DG, by the DDG, and today I'm having another picture of the council. I'm taking so much interest to know because among themselves, I've had somebody saying from the labor, from trade and industry, you know, I think that is, to me, it's very important to know who you are actually, as you are sitting here around. And further, I was just listening and I got that women representation is not yet up to the standard. But, there was that things will come right as time goes on. And one other thing, as we are facing, waiting anxiously, to 2010, yes, as my colleague Maluleka has just pointed out, that we need to see to it that our people are getting some support of some kind from those tourists. But I should think it is a duty from us all to educate the South Africans, women and men, what are they to prepare in order to sell to our tourists? Because you'll find that they will think they can make fat cakes, tomatoes and onions, and they will sit around the streets happily to sell to those tourists. And yet that's not the case. A tourist would like to have something like a wooden watch, beads, you name them, you know, from Africa, isn't it? Or from South Africa. But really and truly, I think it's high time that we must teach the gospel that this and that are their products to be prepared for our tourists to buy when they come. Thirdly, there's this notion of the industry is growing very fast. I had Ms. Ndlumayo mentioning something, you know, which I so followed, that it shouldn't be just the industry is growing, and the chairperson has made mention, unfortunately, he had a chance before me, so I cannot repeat what I wanted to say, because I just wanted to say exactly what he was asking, that if we look at the growth of the industry, are we dividing it to domestic and, you know, because domestic tourism seems not to pull good, because people were not educated that it's not only when you fly over the seas then you become that you become a tourist. They must be educated and be told that there's a wonderful country that has it all. So it is just for them, and they will pay less than flowing over the seas to visit, you name them, Mpumalanga, KZN, you know, Eastern Cape, there are so many of them. They are wonderful. So it is just for us to try and educate our people on that score. And now a man applies for funds to run a business. He gets funding. He starts the business. Well, obviously, business plan is first things first. And I'm telling you, you will so struggle with that business plan, because it will never be approved as the right plan until at times you surrender. But what my question is, the business is now getting on, but it fails to be sustainable. I don't know, monies have been given out, but the business along the way fails to be sustainable. What happens then? Thank you.
Maybe I can come to you just 2 points. I feel I need to put them here so that they can be commended to as well. I think there was a program to promote to small-scale tourism. Was one bread and breakfast or guest houses. What happened to that? There was a scheme that I think government had. Come again? Not shut left. No. TAP, yeah, that's what I'm doing. What has happened to TAP was, I think, I remember speaking to someone, I think from DTI, they said it's being under review. What's the latest on that front? Because if it's under review and it's not coming through, yet the MIDP has not been given more funds by Treasury and big player, that for me is a little bit of a problem. The linked to that, I also think that I think we should be far more bold. We said we are brainstorming here. We should be quite bold. One of the things we need to do is to ascertain how much, based on what Honorable Mokken was saying, how much is spent on hospitality by government. Okay? How much? Okay? And to insist that maybe 60% of that should go to historically disadvantaged at a cost, and you can come up with a model or a criteria or a measuring tool that ensures that you bias your small and medium sized enterprise in the hospitality industry, and you monitor that, and you have annual exposure that this department is not doing it, blah 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 blah. I think for me that's one of the things we need to talk about. Another, the last point that I picked up indirectly with these guest houses in Port Elizabeth is, firstly, what was interesting was that only one person in that forum was black. All the people who were organized were, driving guest houses and all of that in PE. All of them, at least the most active ones, when I saw they, all of them are white. There was only one person who was an African, was in that forum. Now, what I saw, what some of them were raising, they told me that their worry is that there are presently 22 applications in PE for guest houses that local government is looking at. And they are worried that if this continues, it will sink the industry, because there will be too much competition, people won't be able to make money, which is a fair concern. I don't think they're wrong in the economics of it. Now, how do we deal with that? How do we deal with a situation where, and again, from a class point of view, these are, most of them are working class whites. So, they are supposed to be part of the motive forces as a class. So how do you deal with the people who are ordinary South Africans or whites who are controlling an industry? You want blacks to come into that industry. How do we manage this thing of allowing black people not to flood an industry, and at the same time keep whites in that industry in such a manner that everyone can benefit from that industry? So it's a tricky one. So I hope we can comment on. Maybe it has to do with licensing. Maybe we should talk about giving a license over a particular period of maybe 10 years, then renew license after 10 years. I don't know whether that could work, so that you can manage through the licensing thing to ensure that many other people can benefit from it. I don't know. Let's think through this as well. You can now respond, Mr. Sokutu and your team. Okay, so let me take you, and then you'll be the last one.
I'm from Mpumalanga. I just want to find out, because we do have a lot of women who want to get in this industry. They don't have even the channel to get in this industry. Some of them, they said to me, they want to start their own travel agent, but the people they are saying they must get the people from overseas. They're in the rural areas. Where are they going to get those people from overseas? I don't know. I just want to find that. Where the channel to get in this industry, the tourism, because they don't have a clue how to get in this industry. Thank you, Chairperson.
Over to you, Chief.
Chairperson, thank you very much, and thanks for the input from my colleagues and the honorable members. Chairperson, firstly, if you will allow me, I think I'd like to suggest that other members within TEXA who are in the executive should actually give their inputs if they want to, because they are much closer to the ground. They interact with industry much more than we do. They are the executive of TEXA. So I think given that this is a brainstorming session, they should feel free to also contribute if they feel they've got something to add. But certainly, Chairperson, I think that perhaps it's appropriate to start with the question about clarifying how TEXA was formed, because I think, it will give background. the Tourism Empowerment Council of South Africa was established in 2005 in October as per appointment of government, the Minister of Environment Affairs and Tourism. The people were appointed to TEXA were appointed, it was made very clear that they were appointed in their individual capacity. In other words, there was no representative body that was asked to nominate somebody. The minister asked for names, individual names. However, the minister also said that he wanted to ensure that the individuals come from a diverse background of disciplines, so that there are people from business, there are people from labor, there are people from government, etc., etc. So although people were appointed in their individual capacities, and the reason it was like that, Chairperson and other members, government in their wisdom took the view that we need people to exercise objectivity and independence of mind, not to go and fight for positions of organized formations. And I think there are pros and cons of that, but that's how it was established. But if you look at what has happened in the financial sector charter, you might conclude that it's a better model, because financial sector charter almost collapsed because the formation labor took a particular position in communities and there was no movement forward. So I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but I'm saying that's what happened. So it was the first council that has ever been formed by government in terms of the tourism sector, tourism BE charter. After the charter was signed down and the scorecard was agreed by industry, the minister then appointed us as the first council in the tourism sector. And then we have, over and above the council, we have an executive arm that is responsible for the day-to-day activities to carry out projects on a daily basis. And Beulah is the acting CEO. She's got a team of people here with her that work with her in that executive arm. Because all of the council members have got full-time jobs elsewhere. We're all non-executive members here. So we've got full-time jobs elsewhere. However, some of us, when they are here, they're continuing with their day-to-day jobs because they represent government. For example, Representative Cindy Swire, who comes from DIT, and then Jeffrey comes from DTI, and others, I think they're not in. Didi Moyle, who is not with us today, works for FED. And Pat Mokhele, who is from the Northern Cape, is also not here. Now, just to explain how this works, TEXA operates as a business unit within South African Tourism. So the executive arm, in terms of its day-to-day operations and corporate governance issues, is under South African Tourism. The money that comes from government gets transferred to South African Tourism, and then that's how they access it. The council itself does not report to the South African Tourism, it reports to the minister directly. Thank you. But the number of issues that have come up, one of the issues which I want to put on the table is that government has consistently, over many years, not sufficiently come to the party when it comes to funding of the programs that they want to be undertaken. Whether it is in the context of small business enterprises, I'm saying not sufficiently with or advisedly, because maybe in other areas they have, but certainly the areas that I know of, government is always refused to put the necessary resourcing behind what they want, the objectives they want to be met. In my considered view, the council as it is now, I'm talking about TEXA, is inadequately resourced to do what it's supposed to do. Now, one of the first things that we all learn is that if you want something done, you put resource behind it, and you must then get it done. It's inadequately resourced. It's very thinly resourced in terms of structure. itself even before you go to the levels of funding of the structure. And it is a problem which whenever we meet with government, we raise. And in my view, for as long as we have the situation, we will have an ineffective charter if we want to continue with the charter council as it is. So I think that's important to put this on the table, because it leads to the area of why is there no handholding in South Africa. I think, Chairperson, I will not say there is no handholding. There are examples of handholding in certain government departments. There are examples of handholding in the private sector, very successful ones. What is lacking is a systematic way within which handholding is done from a sector to sector. That is what is lacking, which then looks at the whole life cycle of the development of a small entrepreneur. That is, for me, both as my capacity in the council, but as well as my previous roles in government, it is a problem. So we've got examples here and abroad, as you referred, which I think that we can learn from. We also have a structure which was mentioned here, Tourism Enterprise Partnership, whose sole purpose of existence, as I understand it, is to promote and do what needs to be done in order to promote development of small entrepreneurs within tourism sector in particular. On that score, Chair, I should mention that as per discussions with the portfolio committee, other parties were invited to this brainstorming session, and just not to mention them, South African Tourism was invited, Fen Parks for a particular case study were invited, and CETA was invited, and CETA is present here, and I'd like to ask the gentleman to introduce himself, please.
Yeah. I'm Muzi Mwandla from CETA.
Thank you. So there are those other entities that are working in other aspects of the overall transformation basket, if you like. And what we're supposed to be doing as the council is working in partnership in certain areas to support them, or them supporting us, whichever works best, in order to ensure that the whole spectrum of transformation is addressed. I'm told to share the direct response by Jeffrey, that government spends between 3 and 4 billion rand on travel and public sector related services per annum, according to Empowerdex's study. I think in terms of the point that you made, Chair, about insisting on government to spend a certain percentage, we probably need. I agree with the principle. I think that in practice, we probably need to understand the patterns of expenditure within government, so that we can then follow the patterns of expenditure. Because if, for example, for argument's sake, ministerial and presidential functions, and I'm using an extreme example just to illustrate the point, if they all happen in the big cities, we can then insist that they spend money where they don't go. I think that we have to understand the spending patterns, in what sub-sectors do they spend, and then make recommendations in terms of spend accordingly. But also, I thought the point that Jeff made earlier about the Preferential Procurement Act being revised, maybe it would accommodate. I'm hoping that it should accommodate, in fact, some of these differences that have been raised here. No, I'm saying that in terms of government being, in terms of insistence on government spending a certain percentage on tourism, spending it on black or empowered service providers, I said I support the principle, but I think that in order for it to be done, it can't be a blanket percentage that is given. It's got to be done following the patterns of expenditure within that sector by government, and then be able to analytically allocate expenditure in those various sectors that they spend in. That's why I made the example that if they spend 30% on high-level ministerial and presidential functions in the big cities, then there's no point in recommending anything in the rural areas that they spend, because they don't go there. I'm just using that as an example.
So there are some studies that are possibly required. And then in the area of success rate that the Honorable Member raised, I would like to submit that more than the access to funding, the biggest problem is the failure rate of small entrepreneurs, personally. And that's why I said before, while funding is very important and must not undermine it or take it lightly, the success in looking at the life cycle of a small business that is being formed is probably going to be the key to the success of small entrepreneurial development in this country. Because Global Entrepreneur Monitor, they release publications, and every time they include South Africa, every time the success rate of startups or first-time businesses is higher than expected. I forget the actual percentage now, but much higher than acceptable. So we can have 100% of everybody accessing funding, but if 70% of them fail in the first year, it's not helping our cause. So it is a big problem, the non-financial, the readiness of companies to actually take the money and use it as a successful entrepreneur is a very, very big issue for me. So I just want to caution in the discussion because in order for ourselves even a small chance of succeeding, it's important that we are focused. We've talked about everything here within the tourism sector, and the BE Charter Council cannot directly intervene in all those aspects. There are other bodies. We might advise, we might lobby, but there are other bodies, for example, in terms of how to position ourselves, what products are out there, et cetera, et cetera. I'd like to caution that in terms of what we are mandated to do, even though it is broad, we need to be able to say what are the maybe 5 or maybe 10 the most important things that we should focus on in order to move us from point A to point B. Then the last thing is just to clarify, because that issue about level 4 SMEs, et cetera, could be confusing. First of all, the debate around whether there should be sector codes or charter is not about whether one supersedes the other. That's not the point. The point is that is being made, whether people agree with it or not, is that the BE codes are robust enough to accommodate everybody. There does not need to be differences per sector. Now, whether people agree with that or not, I don't know, but that's what is being raised. Not whether one supersedes the other once it comes into the fore. But what was in that discussion, in the BMF stated position, is that you don't need sector-specific nuances, and therefore you don't need the sector charter codes. And that was the point that has been made, that everybody must apply according to the same thing that is in the code of good practice. And I do think that this debate is important because it may supersede us, and because it is raised in other high-level discussions, as I said, in the presidential discussion. And I don't think in the charter space we've sufficiently engaged with it in terms of the various sectors. So those are the just points of clarity that I wanted to make. Thank you.
Okay, I just wanted to comment on the...
Privilege.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to cast some light on what are we as the TEXA team doing to try and address some of the issues that have been raised today, which we are very much aware of, given our limited capacity. One of the things that our Deputy Chair indicated at the beginning was the fact that we have partners that we work with to assist us in delivering on the tourism scorecard. And one of those is the Tourism Enterprise Partnership. Now, specifically looking at the question that was raised around how do communities, townships start benefiting from tourism without people just going in and out. The discussions that we are currently having with the Tourism Enterprise Partnership is that according to the scorecard, on enterprise development, companies are supposed to spend at least 3% of their net profit after tax on enterprise development. Now, enterprise development is actually the main objective of the Tourism Enterprise Partnership. And one of the challenges is having enough finance to develop various enterprises. Now, the discussion we're having with them is that we, as a facilitator of transformation, we will link them to private sector funders who have set aside their 3% net profit after tax for enterprise development, looking for establishments, empowered establishments in the tourism sector to develop. And in the discussions we're having, we're looking at, through TAP, having an enterprise development fund where that 3% net profit after tax will be deposited into, and they, as TAP, will then identify enterprises that can benefit from that fund. Now, the strategy that they're currently employing is one where they've identified the key challenge for most of the black enterprises is access to market, and mostly it's because it's an individual guest house that's trying to attract guests. Now, they've put them into clusters. The strategy is to put various products, crafters, guest houses, various tourism products into clusters, and then market these clusters to international tour operators. In this way, when, for example, the one example they've used is that when someone says they're looking for accommodation in Johannesburg, Soweto, it will indicate, instead of showing Sizilizi's guest house, it will indicate that there are so many rooms or beds available in Soweto, because now it's a cluster. You're not just looking at an individual, but you're looking at what that community has to offer. And that makes it much more attractive for people to start seeing those areas as areas that they could visit, spend the night, spend their money in. Now, on our side, we cannot directly get involved, but through TAP, we are looking at ensuring that we encourage our private sector stakeholders to channel their money through to TAP to allow for these enterprises and clusters to be developed. Because as it is at the moment, they are limited in terms of the clusters that they can develop. And so they have identified those that they feel at the moment they can develop much quickly and get them ready for market. But with access to finance, they will be able to develop more enterprises. On the public sector side, there was an issue raised on the reporting on do government departments report on how much they're spending on empowered entities. And one of the activities that our public sector liaison manager looks after is exactly that, to look at how much are government departments spending on procuring empowered products, and also guiding them in understanding how broad-based BEE works versus narrow-based, which just looks at ownership and doesn't look at what enterprises are doing in the other seven elements. I think CISO will later on just take you through what kind of reporting are we expecting from government and how we are planning to use that as a tool to start enforcing change through procurement of empowered products. Thank you.
There were two other hands. Yeah. Okay, and then we'll come to Cindy and then.
Okay, thank you, Che. Che, you touched on something about what about tapping into the markets for workers in other countries. Now, what we have is this, in FEDUSA we have two of our unions who have their own holiday resorts. Now, it's very interesting to look back, and Sony phoned me one night to say to me, Dennis, we heard something about trade unions are involved in tourism. You see, because you know, committee members were the only thing that we are involved with strikes, you know, and marches, you know. But we are also involved in tourism. And we went back and I had a discussion with them, and we're going to set up a meeting with those unions to learn the lessons from them and how those success stories can be replicated and maybe multiplied in a way that can add value to push up this rate that they say that we want to increase the tourism. What happened was, I think about 20 or 30 years ago, the previous government gave those unions the land, or they gave them the money to acquire the land. So the purpose of this was for them to build a tourism resort that could benefit the members of those unions. So, you know, once a year the members would go and visit those tourism destination. The union runs it, the union operates it, but it cannot sell it. You know, because that thing is now, but it can be also open up for other members of the public to also visit those things. Now, the trade unions in South Africa, Kusatu, NAPTU and FEDUSA, we are affiliated to the International Trade Union Confederation, who has about something of 164 million members internationally. So if we can just take that small case study, and we can encourage other unions also and government to come together in the form of a public-private partnership, imagine the jobs that we can create, you see. Then there is very little risk because we know, you know, if you, the union has something, it's sustainable, it can create jobs, you can put these things up. I mean, there was one union in Cape Town that had a resort on this Baden Powell place, but they neglected the place so much that it actually fell into ruins, and it was, you know, afterwards they just had to give it away. So I think if a person can, with Zoni's support and maybe with the council, put a paper together. Because I don't want us just to have a discussion today and we walk away here and it was just a good discussion and we can classify it as a talk shop. So I think, Chairperson, maybe you had some inspiration to say that we can look on something. So maybe that is something tangible that we can prepare a concept paper of 2 or 3 pages and then see if we can take it forward, because I think it has the potential, because those unions have the one place is in Margate, in Durban. There's other big hotels that already came to those unions and offered them 20 million, 30 million rand just to get their properties now, you see. But the unions run those businesses not for profit, but just to keep it sustainable, to cover the cost and to keep it in, and to also give something back to their members. On the issue of that the lady asked here with regarding to getting into tourism, now I must say, you know, I'm married to a lady that's also in tourism. So it doesn't mean that I sleep with the enemy, you know. But I saw my wife, she's from Cape Town, but is living in Johannesburg now, and she's taking a lot of tourists to Soweto, to the Hector Peterson Memorial, and to also book people in to stay at those guest houses. But I think it just has to grow a little bit more and to get other people. So there's also a network amongst these people to work together, and women have this ability to help one another more than men help. So maybe afterwards I can give you a number and then you can contact her directly.
Thanks. Chairperson, just to provide you with the answer on the question that you raised on statistics pertaining to the revenue of the sectors, I think that is what we're saying is that the 70% value in terms of those entities that contain the 70%, they constitute 20% of the entire industry. All right, and therefore also do note that most of these entities are indeed making profit, and they are making moderate to good profit by and large. And then also what we, if you look on the other side, in terms of the ones that you are looking at, and then the rest then will then really constitute your small, medium enterprises. And then within that particular basket of small and medium enterprises, what we are saying is that in that basket, you do have 60% of those small and micro enterprises, they fall within the ambit of 5 million revenue in terms of 5 million revenue and below. And those now qualify in terms of the scorecard of being exempted to do BEE. Right. So it means that is by and large, they are not required. So in essence, what you are saying, that in that category, by and large, 60% of that category are not going to do anything on BEE. They get an automatic qualification to level 4, as I've explained earlier. So these are the figures in that particular regard. Why we did that, I think the reason is very clear. We wanted to ensure that these entities, most of them, do not make big profit. They are small. And some of them, where they do make something, they just break even on performance, you know, breaking even. So if you're going to start putting BEE requirement on them, you might be increasing really burden and the hurdle that I think our chairperson was raising in that particular regard. So Ito, on that considered view, that particular proposal was made to say that therefore let them be exempted as a way of minimizing BEE as a hurdle rate in terms of ensuring that business grow in this economy and create value. Now, on the other point, I think that is the point the person must understand, is that this debate really around whether entities should be the whole sectors and code and the sector code. That debate has been resolved, really. DTI has expressed this view very clearly. You know, I mean, if you take, for example, the FSC, the Financial Sector Charter, there is no way that the generic code will capture those unique aspects, like funding. You know, BEE funding can never be captured by the generic code of good practice. It can only be expressed by the sector codes within the FSC. And that particular sector code can also set the amount of money that are going to be available to fund empowerment in South Africa. And therefore, if you're going to rely on the generic code of good practice, those things are going to be missed. You know, and then in fact, even also if you go on the ICT sector, the issue of building what we call, in fact, the Presidential Council on the on Information and Technology, which has met, one of the requirements for enterprises really in the ICT sector is that they must go and build, you know, those systems in rural areas and provide access to information technology to our rural side of South Africa. And the generic code will not specify that particular requirement clearly, as it is specified in that sector chart. So I think that is the relevance, really, must never be missed, of these sector codes as relevant in terms of those peculiarities. Or otherwise, those things are going to be, they're very strategic to South Africa, they're going to be very much missed if you're going to miss, because the generic code is not going to deal with all of those nuances in its right. It sets general standard. Then some of these nuances then and the peculiarities will then be lost in the process. And I think that debate really, that is why we're in the status quo, has been resolved by and large, that we need those peculiarities, and therefore the sector codes must continue because they will express those particular things very clearly. Like, for instance, the sector determination. Here, if you look at this industry, we have just put very clearly that certain sectors have far much more smaller enterprises, so you allow sector determination to determine who constitutes a small enterprise, who constitutes an exempted micro, so that these things can be determined in the sectors. And then now those particular unique characteristics and unique features really becomes relevant. I don't know that debate. I mean, I know that our black business have raised these issues because they are worried about the fact that if you allow this sector pose, what's going to happen is that industry will shoot down targets. You know, the issues around targets, that the sector codes should not give rise to smaller targets rather than the ones that have been set out by the generic code of good practice. That is the by and large the concern, really. But it means, therefore, the industry must take care of those particular concerns without necessarily throwing the baby with the bathwater, really, and throw away these particular sector codes. And in the process, South Africa, I think, is going to lose greatly in that particular regard. Now, the other point that I just wanted to mention, the hand-holding in South Africa, it's something that we have never invested on it very big, Chairperson, and I'm going to be very frank about it. We've got an agency that is called SEDA, Small Enterprise Development Agency, that must play that particular role, broadly speaking, in the entire economy of South Africa. But we've never given it enough resources, and I think we need to upscale and give it much more resources. And usually, because it has to deal with all of these economies, I mean, from tourism to all the sectors, manufacturing to all the sectors, and then therefore the requirement is huge. It also means that government must be prepared if we need to capacitate that agency to bring and build more resources available. I mean, I know that there is a debate currently about $300 million was given to SEDA. I mean, in what we want to go, we need more than just $300 million that was spent on a particular a basis. More resources must be available. The challenge of small business in South Africa requires far bigger resources than just $300 million, which tends to be punted as a bigger investment that government has made. If you look at it in terms, in the context of the demands and the challenges, that $300 million really is very minuscule, I must say, Chairperson, in my view, and we need to increase more resources available for that hand-holding to take place in a much more earnest way. Thank you very much.
But there's one question that didn't answer, which is these 5 million, this 60% that you say is about, makes about 16, 5 million a year,
together, what is the value of what they make? What are the revenues in that small business? If you got that, that would be useful.
Well, I think that is, we don't have the total value of that particular sector. I think it's something that we will need to research moving forward so that we can know in real terms the total value of that section constitute how much. I think that is, it's something for research to determine. Thanks.
Because that could also determine to what extent we address the issue of licensing. That could determine the extent to which you address the issue of licensing. If, for instance, if you feel that maybe the billions of rents are talking about, even though the individual units are small, then that remains a lucrative industry for people to participate in. Therefore, how do we ensure that in bigger numbers, historically disadvantaged people are able to participate? What regime do you put in place for that? So for me, it's a relevant issue. That we must separate the forest from trees on. Okay. I've noted you.
Okay. Can I just respond on that issue? Currently, the tourism's contribution to the economy is 159 billion. So if we think of the 80-20 principle, so it means that the 20% of 159 billion is the contribution of the smaller players to the economy.
Is there any mathematician?
Yeah, somebody's got a calculator. Yeah. So if 20% of the 159 billion.
No. I'm not mathematically inclined. But if you say it's 30 billion, that's a lot of money. So it becomes very. So whilst we may not use this strategy to transform it, transformation must happen. We have a lot of money, and so we must find what steps your own response as the council should be to say, how do we transform that sector? So we want something concrete around what ideas we have with the Gatwa Pata sector. I noted your hands, and then I'll come back to you. And then all of you in the end there.
Thank you, Chair. I think there are a couple of things that that I could maybe respond to, which was raised on the other side of the table. I think in the first instance, when you talk about transformation of the industry, there are really two categories. It's the transforming of the existing businesses, and then it's clearly bringing new product to the market, which actually transforms the face of the tourism business as people know it. And that is what I think the gentleman there referred to, as in areas like Soweto, how do you get more guest houses, how do you get hotels, and I think the first thing is, as I said, the guiding principle that we had was that the more profitable the businesses are, the more onerous the requirements on them should become. And in the sense that you don't want the business to go under because of the pressure you put on when it's still small, but as it grows bigger, it's capable of adding to its burden. And I think from that point of view, the process that we've gone through in the charter was quite a long process, about 18 months it took us to develop the scorecard and the charter. Was very good in terms of getting a buy-in from the industry. And we'll find that from the 80% that we talk about now, that control, the 20% controls 80% of the business, that I would say 80% of those businesses has done empowerment transactions to a very large extent, has got enterprise development programs, has got very advanced strategic management programs in place, and have actually responded positively. The difficulty that we face is that at the bottom end of the market, as Jeffrey was saying, the people who make 5 million turnover or less, by and large in the industry, you will work on approximately a 10% margin on profit before tax if you're a successful business. So if you make 5 million turnover, you make 500,000 rand a year. That's a lot less than you guys are making on the other side. So, to impose a lot of burden on those guys to try and, within that framework, that was a great difficulty. No, so the only point that we're trying to make was that really it's very, a lot of those businesses are marginal. We constituted then at Texas a finance, we got a service provider to do a detailed evaluation for us on the funding options available for the tourism industry and to try and understand for us why we are backing so much at the bottom end of the sector. And they did a very detailed study for us. And if I can just summarize the findings of some of those issues. One, very few of the banks and the financial institutions actually are dedicated tourism
departments that would deal with tourism businesses. In many instances, at the small end of the industry, it will be guest house owners, people who convert the farm into a lodge and so forth, which means that they actually get funding via a home loan or on such a way. They don't really get funded as a tourism enterprise. And in many instances, we find that the actual profitability, the banks are very concerned about the actual profitability of a lot of those tourism enterprises, because really, if you look at what the people actually make and what they think they make, there's quite a big difference. The whole issue of sector accounting, where we have a tourism sector, which we can demonstrate to the banks very clearly how much the tourism industry generates and what the value chain in tourism looks like, will help us a lot in trying to get the banks to have more dedicated tourism departments. So that was the first one. Concern with no department. Secondly, was the lack of inherent profitability. A lot of tourism businesses look very sexy, they look attractive, but they don't make money. And we found that's why in the end, in the bottom of that sector, we weren't not much concerned about it, because a lot of them, it just doesn't make enough money to be of concern. Now, overall, I agree with the chairperson that 30 billion, if that's the number, I know we don't have precise statistics on it, it's a big number, but if you split it up in many small fractions per individual, it's not that much money. So I think then the next question was, how do we then transform the face of the industry? And I think that goes very much back towards where South African tourism and the tourism board must work hand in hand with institutions such as TEXA and the department and then DTI. And that's really, A, from a marketing point of view, that we actually give more exposure to that product than we would give to established businesses. And in SA Tourism, we do that in the end of the day. We must then make sure that the standards of those things are equivalent to what do people expect when they come here. And I think Mr. Slumar can help me there, but I think roughly the split between local and international tourism is roughly 50-50. May not be complete in terms of the total contribution to our economy. The fact of international tourism, why it's so powerful, is that all new money. So if we get 80 billion rand worth of international tourism receipts back in the country, it's all money that comes from a different country to our country. If we take 80 billion through domestic tourism, it just moves from one form of spending to another form of spending within the economy. So clearly, a lot of the actual value that's created in terms of value to the country is created by foreign tourism. And that's why that's important. At SA Tourism, we've been driving this demand for authentic South African product very hard. And we're trying to get the tour operators to include it in it. Clearly, they must, you know, from that must translate in more black-owned businesses in those areas that actually own authentic product. And that is a process that unfortunately takes some time, partly because of difficulty that people have in funding that. I think in terms of, and what's interesting, I don't know when you've last been to Soweto to see what's happening there now. It's very, very interesting. In the last 12 months, one hotel group has actually opened, international hotel group, in the Holiday Inn group in Soweto, and four or five of the other major chains are building hotels in Soweto. Why that is important is simply that they have got the money to and the marketing power to get people to stay in that area. That allows the smaller entrepreneurs to establish enterprises there, which actually feeds off those things. Very few people will have the first time go and stay there in Frank's Bed and Breakfast. It's too unknown. Even though there are very successful bed and breakfast operations in Soweto. But, I mean, if he stays at the Holiday Inn for the first time, or you get a great experience, the second time to stay somewhere else is a lot easier. And we find internationally it's a phenomenon in the tourism industry that people first follow the big brands, and on the second and other visits actually start looking at the other players for a more genuine experience. So I'm actually quite encouraged by what's happening there, and I think if it works correctly, that we'll get a lot of benefit in there, and where we'll translate economic benefit into the area itself. In terms of the codes as it is at present, the only way that we can encourage businesses to do that is through the enterprise development component of it, where we're actually asking people to twin or to help develop businesses. And I know both City Lodge and Southern Sun Hotel Group have specific programs, and I think Pretoria has something like, where they're actually now twinning or supporting or educating people in those areas to in hospitality establishments. Really what we need in this regard is a much greater effort. In the past, we had this scheme from the Department of Tourism, from DTI, whereby they facilitated investment in rural areas, whereby you got back a certain percentage of the capital you spent, you got 30% back over 5 or 6 years. I know of a very significant number of tourism enterprises that utilized that incentive to establish hotels, operations, stuff. And it actually created, because tourism is such a good multiplier, it actually created a lot of job opportunity. If we link a similar product to an empowerment requirement, so that if you want to do it, you need to be 51% or 26% background, depending on how we work, and you have to be a category X performer in that period of time. And we link that. I think something like that will help very strongly to develop quality product in those areas and give the necessary incentive. So this, the next thing is that we need to do is we need to enable SA Tourism to get a greater budget so that they can spend more money on issues that will not give us a reward in the first 2 to 3 years, but long-term are very important to our country. If you look at the budget of SA Tourism, it's now static for the next couple of years. It's grown. But really the demand for product and the product that we need to market out there in a very competitive international marketplace, you know, it's actually in real terms our contribution is declining. And SA Tourism's ability to work with us to market new product is actually declining simultaneously. So I think to really transform the industry, get lots of black-owned business that are successful, up and running, and got the capacity to go out there, will need from government side significant greater intervention, SA Tourism and DTI level, together with us. Otherwise, we just can't do it.
Those on the far end of the opportunity.
Thank you, Chair. I just need to pick up maybe two or three sections of the hospitality industry. With regards to accommodation, yes, it is a fact. My colleague has just mentioned about the examples in Soweto and the occupancies. But what needs to be known as well is there are a lot of people those are interested in running guest houses, and they do open. But the occupancy in the township remains low. And there are reasons to that. Either out of that 30 billion, how many people stays in the township? That's another thing. But in terms of the failure of the bed and breakfasts and the guest houses, depending on the position, because it's important, it's not as simple as opening a guest house or a bed and breakfast just anywhere. It's important that it is in the right position. One other area which has not been touched, it's not tourism or hospitality, it's not only about accommodation. There are restaurants. How many people are entering that market? The other thing is the transport, the tour operators. You find that the licensing process is a problem. Somebody has an appetite to go and attend a course as a tour operator and at later stage even arrange finance to get a kumbi, a quantum. That person has got everything, but he cannot get a license, transport, to operate. Now, what happened to the installment of that vehicle? You go to the provincial structures, it takes forever. I know of many people, those who have acquired brand new, by the time when you get the license, that kumbi has been repossessed. It's a practical example. So those are some of the things which needs to be looked at. You get few blacks, those who want to enter the hospitality industry in the township, maybe he can source funds and only to find that he does not have a license to operate the bed and breakfast in the township, in the suburb, because the rezoning process is a nightmare as well. Now, the local structures as well, they need to make sure there's a consistency in terms of the system. You go to Durban, apply for rezoning, different rules from Johannesburg, different rules from Cape Town, different rules from PE. Now, with the 2010, we expect the Auntie Mary and Brajo to benefit from. How can they benefit if they don't have license? We need to put systems which will enable them to run these businesses. So, you right now, if you go and apply for rezoning with all the requirements, it will take an average, maybe, if you're lucky, a year. But next year, in 2009, there's a big game happening in this country. 2010, of course, everybody knows. But how do we
benefit out of it. It's important that the systems respond to the transformation agenda. If we want to transform fast track and say get people to benefit, and on the other hand, legislate the laws prevent us from operating, what comes first between the egg and the chicken? That those are the things which you need to look at times, or probably we need to look at it, the you know, as from the industry point of view. The other thing relating to an issue of economy, when the tourist comes to the country, they go to Gugulethu, to Soweto, Mdantsane. We expect these people to buy something, but there's nothing to buy. Because when a bus comes, takes people to Hector Peterson, in around there, things which are being sold, the question must be asked, where do they come from? Are they from Zimbabwe? Or are they from the DRC? Because when you look at it, some of them are not crafted here. What is that we are doing to make sure that our own community craft these things and make them available? Somebody raised the issue of tourism development. It's an important one. And most people, they undermine that responsibility of tourism development. South African tourism brings people. As a marketing organ of the country. But do we have people, have we trained people or skilled our people to make sure that we create things to buy? Let's take a practical example right now. You go to Gugulethu, enter in 108. Either you walk, or you cycle, or you drive. Apart from the main sport, I don't know if he's still flying, the Mzoli, what else do you get? But we say, no, we want to do things for our people. But what is that the local structure, provincial structure has put in the township so that Mr. Brown, when he comes from the UK, he can use his pounds, dollars, whatever it is, in the township. The issue of settlement restructuring. There's nothing. They go and make a turn there with their money and come back. Okay. If the guest house is there, believe you me, that person has tried to make an application to be licensed properly. The only people, those who have done a good job, is the grading council, because they've gone to grade it. But if you check, has that property been rezoned? You'll find that no. You go to NY1, that very long street, nothing to buy, except that there's a taxi rank. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Two of my points have been covered by Frank. The first one on tourism satellite accounting, so I'm not going to repeat that. But I'd like to touch briefly on the question that you raised, Mr. Chair, the one on the TGI incentive program. Previously, the program used to be called the SMEDP, Small and Medium Enterprise Development Program. It has since been reviewed and relaunched. I think it was on the 21st of July. It's now called the Enterprise Investment Program, EIP. And within EIP, we have a tourism, TTI has a tourism a support program, TSP. What we're doing as TEXA, we're going to partner with TTI to roll out information and awareness around the new incentive to the provinces. We work with a structure that's called the provincial focal points. So we're going to be inviting TTI to come and brief us about the scheme. In very briefly, the scheme looks at a couple of criteria that I'd like to touch on, which provides a deviation point from the previous SMEDP. First one, it looks at it emphasizes job creation, that if you apply for this scheme, you need to show that a minimum of 8 jobs will be created before you access the scheme, minimum of 85, and the max is 85 jobs. And also it looks at, it emphasizes geographic spread, because as it has been alluded earlier on, that tourism is largely concentrated in metros, Joburg, Cape Town, and Etegwini. What the scheme is looking at is to, if you like, subsidize enterprises that are in rural areas and marginalized metros. For instance, somebody who's in Joburg but in Soweto can access the scheme, et cetera. And they look at they finance 30% of the qualifying investment costs for a period of 3 years. So these are just some small knowledge that I have acquired from the DCIS scheme. But as I say, that we'll find a way to probably feedback the committee on and probably get the DTI to do a proper presentation on the scheme. And secondly, the question of public sector contributing to us achieving the, I think from the, you know, couple of months that we've been engaging in different provinces with the public sector, whereby we've been talking with chief financial officers, supply chain managers, etc. I see that there is now a move towards supporting BEE, because as Jeff reported earlier on, that the public sector still procures using the Preferential Procurement Framework Act. These workshops have assisted the public to realize that there are so many flaws in the PFA. And when we describe BEE in tourism, they realize that BEE has even better benefits, or it will ensure that a number of elements are being done by an enterprise before they get, if you like, a government business. And I'm also delighted to inform that the National Treasurer, which is the custodian of the PPFA, is putting into place interim measures, and they will be reporting at our national conference in about a week's time or 2 weeks' time on what it is that the steps that they have taken to ensure that the public sector plays an active role in supporting broad-based black economic empowerment. And finally, despite the constraints that we have witnessed from PPFA, there are provinces that have taken initiatives to run with broad-based BEE. For instance, the KwaZulu-Natal, they've come up with a provincial strategy on how they're going to drive BEE in the province, Gauteng provincial government, Northern Cape, etc. And what has been the most common factor in those provinces is that they've they've worked together with the provincial treasurers to ensure that they are they are singing from the same hymn towards the implementation of broad-based black economic empowerment. So there is work that has been done in that regard, to ensuring that public sector leads by example by procuring from empowered enterprises. Thank you.
Can I ask a question? Is there someone who's recording this discussion as it is in its totality? I know you're doing that for Parliament, but is there someone else? You are?
I'm taking it.
Okay. Because I think that there are very good points that are coming through, and I'm worried that I won't want those to be lost at all. I think the last intervention was quite useful. If you could make your presentation, sir.
Thank you, Chair. At FICA, we also believe that there is an important relationship, in fact, more of a symbiosis relationship between skills development and economic empowerment. And CETA as such cannot operate in a vacuum. As a result, we at CETA, we also need the enterprises. And what is then interesting about the enterprises that we have is that they are the workplaces that provide training avenues for skills development to take place. But now the way we define and the way we look at the enterprises that exist out there is somehow different from the DTI kind of definition of the enterprises. For example, if we look at the SMEs, we define SMEs first based on the payroll, that is those that are exempted from paying the skills levy. And also we define our SMEs by looking at the number of employees that are working for that particular enterprise. And to a certain extent, then this deviates from how the economic empowerment movement or the transformation agenda will be in place. As a result, when then we take stock of the enterprises out there, what is eminent is that we've got over 40,000 enterprises in the tourism sector, out of which just about 20,000 enterprises are known to CETA, in other words, are registered with CETA in our database. And then out of that 20,000, it's only about 1,000 enterprises that actually participate in skills development. By participation, I mean enterprises that pay skills levy and submit a workplace skills plan to CETA. And then given that, it then translates to the fact that there is a very small fraction of the entire 159 billion rand that is generated by the industry that is now being allocated to training. As a result, CETA will just have something about 100 million available per year for skills development, which by all standards is a very tiny amount and cannot at this stage certainly be expected to make a huge impact. But as it may be, what is also important with our definition of our SMEs is that at the end of the day, we are left with about 98% of the tourism industry is then made up of the SMEs. And those are the SMEs that are exempted from paying the skills levy. That's one point. Another thing that I would like to quickly mention is that this year, as of 2008, I think we received about 10,000 applications, that is now individuals applying for learnership placement. And out of that, we could only fund about 1,000, which again becomes a drop in the ocean. Well, we do have leadership programs that are in place. We do have various projects that are addressing the skills development issues, but the point is that there is insufficient funding towards that. Maybe because of the way in which the system was designed, the levy system. And other than the financial problem in terms of a budget available to address the training needs, there is also funding with regard to the capacity or the resource that is available to disperse those funds. If you remember the levy model, the way the Department of Labor has designed it is that CETAs can only use 10% of their income to administer and to do everything else. In other words, they cannot then use other money outside of that so as to boost their capacity. So I would actually say that that is one problem that is there in terms of the CETA capacity, in especially for the smaller CETAs, like I'll refer to our CETA as one of the SME CETA. And one last thing of which I think is now going to be resolved. Sitters, including a sitter, who have been training probably at the entry level, and the problem being the N2F level, whereby sitters would only operate between level NKF level 1 to 5. And that has been the emphasis of training. As a result, in terms of addressing the high-level skills which are actually required and needed by the BE in particular, that has not been forthcoming. Now, I'm saying that now because the NQF bill, which I understand has been passed by Parliament, is now going actually to pave the way, because now sitters are going to be able to train from NQF level 1 to 10. So the new quality council for trades and occupation is actually going to pave the way, and then for it will be positioned, or sitters will then be positioned to be able to support training at all NQF levels. Thank you, Chairman.
I think we're going to try and sum up the issues and try and conclude the meeting. At least every member had an opportunity to comment. I will indulge you, Braden, and then I'll ask Mr. Sokoto to comment, and we've seen it, and then we'll try and have the meeting.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to comment in terms of, you know, many a times we talk about skills, training, different sorts of things. And when I look around South Africa, you know, we are blessed because we've got human resources. We have the people. And the people have skills. When I talk in terms of skill, I'm talking in terms of a person that can take leather and make a shoe. That person is skilled, but that person may not have the education to know how to put together business prospectus to go to a bank and borrow money. We have a lot of people who are unemployed in this country who have MBAs, who are walking around the streets. Can't we at least put common sense into gear and at least have money to say that, okay, let us identify those people who have the necessary skills to put together business packages so that when you go to a financial institution, it makes sense. But government must lead by example. If I were to put a question to the Department of Trade and Industry and say, what department is allocating 25% of their budget to buy certain goods? Which goods can be produced by a person in the township somewhere? Let's say, for instance, let's take the Department of Defense for argument's sake. They wear boots. But can't we set aside a certain amount of it and identify those people with MBAs and say, you go to the township and identify people that can produce the same boot according to the specifications. And once you begin doing that, you would be taking those people out of that informal sector, bringing them into the formal sector, because they would then have to be assisted by this MBA to put together a business proposal and bid for that job from government to produce the same stuff according to government specifications. Now, those people would then be in a position to employ many more other people who are now going to be working in that facility, earning money, and contributing towards the tax base as well. Now, these are the types of common horse sense things that one would like to see happening. And if government would start leading by example, doing those kinds of things, the health department, who does the laundry for their health services, the hospitals? And how many of our sisters are sitting around in the townships who can clean those things?
And all you need is a warehouse and a boiler room in order to be able to do that kind of things. So if we can start thinking along those lines, I think we would make a very big difference. I just wanted to contribute there. Thank you.
Can I have you, Cindy, and then the chairperson will have the final word.
I think for me, Chair, what has been coming out of this is that without addressing the fundamentals, we're not going to move forward in terms of solving the issues. And I think this country has had lots of very good strategies. And I just want to start back with the Tourism White Paper of 1996, which talk about all the issues that have been raised in the House. It talks about the need to transform the industry. It talks about the need to build and diversify products that we offer. It talks about broadening our marketing. It talks about opening up opportunities for people who've never traveled to travel. It talks about all those good things. However, if that is not funded, we're not going to be able to do that. And I think the fundamental is that we've got this sector which has been positioned as going to be the messiah for the economy of South Africa. But the truth of the matter is that we're not funded. And I must say, I think the DG will say exactly what I'm going to say. Last week we had an engagement with Treasury, and where we were told that the only additional funding that is available is going to go to ESCOM, and it's going to go to 2010, and there's nothing that is going to be allocated to tourism. So we can talk and we can have all these plans, but if we do not have funding that is dedicated to making it happen, we're not going to move forward. Our chairperson mentioned the issue that TAXA is underfunded. There's no way you can transform the sector with the budget that they're getting. I used to be the head of Secretariat. I understand exactly what he's talking about. There's no way we can market in those markets that we cannot reach if we do not have adequate resources that we have. So the issue is that we have this sector that has been poised as going to be so much to everyone, but without the support of the House, without the support of everyone, we're not going to be able to move forward. And I just want to use an example of Singapore. Singapore, we had them coming here last week, and they were sharing with us in terms of how they've developed tourism and how they have really capitalized on service excellence. And what they told us, which is a lesson that I think we need to learn as a country, was that anything happens by design. You can have a plan, but if you do not fund that plan, you cannot move forward. They told us that when they were separated from Malaysia, they were a tiny country and with nothing, no mines, nothing, etc. But the only thing that they had was people. So they began to capitalize on using people by developing the service industry. Government invested in that to make it happen. Look at where they are now. And then another analogy that I've had was around Malaysia and Ghana. Those two countries, 50 years ago, they were under colonialism. And last year, both of them were celebrating 50 years of freedom from colonialism. Look at the two countries, Malaysia, where Malaysia is now, where Ghana is now. And it cannot happen on its own. You need government that is going to put in place mechanisms to make it happen. We can write papers. We can be the best bureaucrats ever. We can get our salaries. But if whatever we have in our mind is not supported by funding, we will sit here 50 years ago. We'll be same as Malaysia, Ghana, and sitting where things are. And my appeal for me is that moving forward, this is about BEE, but I know that BEE, without other facets of tourism being getting the support that they require, we're not going to move forward. And I think we need to raise this debate beyond just focusing on one area. Let's talk about the funding for the sector. Is it adequate to take us where we want to be? Is it adequate to create the jobs that we've put forward? And as a department, we're currently developing a five-year tourism growth strategy. We've looked in terms of what is happening globally. We've listened to what has been said here. It's a grand plan, and when I look at it, I feel good, but I know that without budget, if we're still going to get what we have, then we're not going to move forward. So for me, I think the fundamental issue here is about that. And if we don't solve that, we will come here, we will have plans, we will have everything, we will know exactly how we're going to do, but without funding to implement those plans, then we will keep coming here and saying industry is not transforming, we're not getting the right tourists, we're not getting the right products, etc. So for me, I think, in closing from my side, I think that's something that we need to take up out of this room and take it bigger than here to make it happen. And it won't happen on its own. We need to just do it.
Thank you.
So good. Chairperson, honorable members, some very important insights have come through in this discussion. I can assure you, Chairperson, that while there are new insights that have come through in the induction, there are a number of them that we've been discussing year after year after year after year, the same thing, but without much movement forward. There's an issue, Chairperson, which you've raised, which we I don't think we responded to at all. When you referred to your experience in the Eastern Cape about those white guest house owners, Chairperson, let me assure you that what you saw there is a macrocosm of what you find in any big city in South Africa. If you went to a meeting of business in South Africa, anywhere, whether in Joburg or in Durban, you'll find that 80% are white people. If it's a meeting of CEOs, for example, that's what you'll find. So the same is true in the area of concern that you're referring to, that if it's a forum of owners, 80% or 100%, whatever it will be. I think what we need to understand also is the unintended consequences of the scorecard. It being a balanced scorecard means you can score more in other areas and score very little in other areas, and I should not care about it because you get the minimum point that you require from a PE point of view. It's an unintended consequence, but it is one of the consequences where people say, well, actually, I don't need to put energy in that area because I'm going to score points in the other area. So I think that's something that we need to look at. So the one area which I think that we didn't discuss sufficiently, and I think points back to our approach and perhaps unintended consequences of entitlement. Back home, in a small little town, about a year ago, there were only four salons or hair, what do they call? Hair shops, dressers. Hair salons, yeah. There were only four of them. All four of them were run by foreigners, African foreigners, from Mozambique, Zimbabwe, etc. And I asked two people, why is this? Why is it none of our people actually, I mean, how can it be difficult to run a hair salon? How much money can you need as a startup to run a hair salon? And the answer, I admit that it's not scientific, but both those people said, we don't have the patience that the people from outside have in terms of living on meager earnings and patient going up every morning and living on meager earnings from this. We don't have that. We want a job, want to be employed by government. Those are the responses of these two people that I have. I do think that while unscientific as it is, it does point to a certain sense of entitlement, which we may have created unintentionally as well. But also perhaps it may also be a reflection of the impact of apartheid on our people on the ground. But it that entrepreneurial drive, it does have its own contribution, and we don't have as much as I think we should have in this country. There are some important areas here which I think that we could, without further discussing them, make the necessary submissions to the relevant government departments. The obvious one is the regulatory hurdles. I'm sure that representations have been made. However, I think that we can't give up because the point that Eddie Koza made, that it takes years, that the laws are difficult, there's too much formality, etc., it is a critical point in this. we have to look at BE in a holistic sense and not have one instrument that must intervene and then solve everything else. So I think that there are a number of very important things that have come out of here on our side, Chair and Honourable Members. We will, even though this is not a decision-making forum, we will take some recommendations and take them forward. I think that I should just thank my colleagues and other people that came with us here, and also thank you for the time that you've I'm allocated to engage with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sokutu. Again, I think in closing the meeting, firstly, let me apologize and indicate that there is lunch and it's free. We don't have to buy lunch. Where is it going to be? It will be in the old assembly dining hall. It's a sit-down lunch. You can sit down. It's a three-course meal for free. So you go ahead and enjoy yourselves. Unfortunately, I won't be able to join you because I've got another meeting that I've got to run to. I think going forward, I think this has been a useful exercise. We look forward to the submission of the issues. We will maybe have another rejoinder to them, maybe a written one. We don't have to meet again. But whatever came out of this, that's why I was so concerned about the minute taking of this meeting. Whatever work plan that comes out of this, please refer it to us. We may want to engage with it. I think it would be useful that maybe the Transformation Empowerment Council looks at the creation of a black forum. Black people who are affected by tourism in us, they must have a network, they must come together. So that government across this country is forced to meet with them, knows who they are, and responds and engages with them. Can't leave this thing vague. Yes, they'll be part of broader forum, that one in Port Elizabeth, they'll be part of the broader sector, but also as black people, they need to have a forum. So I think it would be useful that you should take such a step and promote the creation of that. Secondly, what I would say to the comrade from FEDUSA, I think what I was raising with regard to trade union, it's not only just about trade union hotels or vacation structure. That's important. I think something that we want to engage with. The point I was raising was that you might want to capture them at home to speak to TNG in the UK, to speak to them and show that in their own magazines they promote visiting South Africa, and that when visiting South Africa they go to places where black people stay, or where they can ensure that they experience the diversity of South Africa. You capture them before they come. I think that there are many constituencies that we can talk to, progressive intellectuals, most people are involved in what's called the ethical sector. It's growing. All these people who eat organic food, that's the kind of people who may begin to, no, seriously, these are the kind of sensitive people that may be willing to experience a broader experience when they come to South Africa. So part of whom we need to target are such sensitive sections of society, particularly in the north. When it comes to, and some of them, for instance, there's been this movement against the World Bank. If we could ensure that when there are such big batches on the World Bank, we pamphleteer people there. Those are middle class, not only when it comes. And ensure that, they when they come to, because they have destroyed Europe because of industrialization. So there's no biodiversity. It's a barren land. It's not efficient machine society. They want to see the elephant. They want to see biodiversity. They have no notion of it. And so that they come to us. And in coming to us, and so that they also spend with their money with black people. The issue of CEDA, I think, again, the fundamental thing is funding this initiative. It's a very, very important. Some of us have been saying that this is a joke. This 20 million has always been a joke. Okay? What we should be talking about is at least 10 billion a year. Okay? Understanding whatever failure is that are there. But if you have got the proper institutions, I'm convinced that I think places like Norisma, that is this hand-holding company in Italy. I don't. But if you've got any failure, it's probably maybe 10%.
and they've been able to transform the structure of the economy over the past since 45, since the Second World War. I mean, so why don't we look at those examples? Okay, they came in there with they were idealists, they were radicals. But they said that if we are not going to have socialism, at least we'll have a capitalism that has a human face. And these are the structures we'll ensure to create it. And they've created it. Okay? So I think we should look at, and they fund the whole thing. I'm not joking. All you're required to do in Bologna, in Emilia Romagna, you only have got to have the business plan. That's all you need. They'll give you the money, they'll give you the market, they'll give you the technical research of the product if you are manufacturing. Everything, they'll do everything for you. All we have to do is have the business plan. And if they approve that business plan, off and running. So I think we may want to learn from that. And maybe we might want to engage DPSA and IDC around a specific instrument for us here. I'm almost through. So we might want to do that. I think that's why I'm saying we need to be robust. You see, we had a big fight in the ANC in Polokwane. Some call it a democratic contestation. If that contestation is to be more than just the individuals that were elected, okay, at least we need to prepare that our institutions ensure that there's a dividend post Polokwane. Okay, that pain that we went through, what was that a waste? And therefore, these things that we've been talking about, that there should be a new growth path, there should be a new accumulation regime, means that we should get money where we need money. So those people, whoever won there, they have promised, they fought a fight on a certain basis, with certain, let them deliver. Let's insist that there's a delivery and all structures of government. But I think for me, we're almost as we were in 94. There's a coalition of forces that have won in the ANC that claims to represent certain values. Let's see the action. So what I'm saying is that let us all be ready to ensure that we get something out of that. The last point I would like to say is that if you're having problems with treasury around motivating some of these things, we are in the process of passing a law here in Parliament where we will amend the money bill. So if they don't give you the money, we might just give you the money. So at least come to us also early on, because we want to be able to say to the treasury, they must justify their budget. Okay? They must explain to us why this is labor-intensive sector is not being supported yet. The nuclear sector, which is probably going to create maybe jobs for security guys managing those machines, that they should get these billions of rand. They have to justify that. So with that, thank you very much for the interaction. We look forward to further interaction. And again, thank you for coming over to think with us on these very important things. Thank you very much. Thank you.